From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Take 2, me, Martinez. Heads up, Prop 13 is on Tuesday's ballot. No, not the property tax one. This one is aimed at public school construction and renovation from K through college. But there's something in the fine print that could be easy to miss. We will make you aware. Plus, Malcolm X is more associated with New York City than anywhere else. However, he once held a press conference in downtown LA that's still remembered 60 years later. It's all ahead on Take 2. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take 2. I'm Amy Martinez. Thanks for joining us. Coming up on the show, we'll continue our series about the drama unfolding around the Orange County School of the Arts, a public charter school that doesn't always act as one. Plus, we listen back to some rare footage of a press conference that Malcolm X once gave in downtown Los Angeles in 1962. But we start with the latest information about coronavirus, officially known as COVID-19. Now, earlier today, Governor Gavin Newsom broke down the number of cases in the state.
We have 33 confirmed positive tests for the virus. Five individuals have subsequently moved out of state. So there are 28 people that we know in the state of California that are positive.
It's cause for concern, but not necessarily alarm. A study by the Chinese government says the vast majority of COVID-19 cases, 81%, were mild, and that those affected made a full recovery. Most mild cases resembled a common cold, and like the cold or flu, it's people with compromised immune systems that are most at risk when catching it, such as young children and the elderly. So to stop its spread means taking simple steps that many of us are very familiar with, like washing hands with soap and water, both at the same time. But there's another important one that many of us might not even use to our benefit, and that's paid sick leave. Here to talk about it is Ruth Milkman, professor of labor and sociology at City University of New York and former director of the UCLA Institute for Research on Labor and Employment. Welcome.
Thank you.
First, can you underscore for us how paid sick leave might prevent the spread of sicknesses such as the flu or in what we have going on right now, COVID-19?
Almost any workplace where there's more than one person working can communicate an illness that they're suffering from to their coworkers. And then in cases like restaurants or other food service settings, or even in retail settings where there's a lot of interaction with the public, workers can also infect customers and clients. I mean, there's an old joke among the people who advocate for paid sick leave, and it's, you know, would you like some flu with those fries? You know, that is the situation. So it's in the public interest as well as in the worker's interest to have these kind of protections.
Yeah, it sounds like a no-brainer, right? Just if you're sick, stay away from people and then you don't pass it on. Now, in 2014, California passed a law to guarantee full-time workers 3 days of paid sick leave each year. What's been the effect of that on employers and employees in the state since it went into effect?
So for those who are covered by that law, and it isn't quite everyone, because like if you're a new employee in a workplace, you have to accrue the hours of paid sick time, and that takes a little while. But for those who are covered, it means that they do not have to choose between a paycheck and their house or their family's house. Before the law was passed, and in many places still in the United States, people feel that they can get fired if they take a sick day. And they, in fact, they are fired regularly for doing so, especially if it happens like more than once in a year or whatever. So these laws are designed to protect workers against that kind of treatment.
What's been the economic impact since this law went into effect?
Well, the evidence we have suggests that the impact is virtually zero. Mm-hmm. Employers tend to resist the passage of any regulation, including these kinds of laws. We saw that in California with paid family leave and again with paid sick days. They're kind of allergic, if you'll pardon that expression, to any kind of regulation. It's understandable. They want to run their own businesses without anybody telling them what to do. But in some cases, including this one, it's actually in their interest, too, you know, to minimize the spread of infections among their own workforce as well as the clients and customers that they get business from.
Ruth, does this law also protect part-time workers? I'm thinking food service workers, maybe ones that work through Uber or Lyft. Any incentives for them to stay home?
So Uber and Lyft, I mean, this is being debated right now in California. You know, those workers are not considered employees under the law. They're considered independent contractors. So they are not usually covered by these laws. So that's a limitation. However, part-time workers who work for an ordinary business, say McDonald's or any restaurant, they are covered even if they're part-time. They just accrue the hours of paid sick time more slowly than a full-time worker would. But it's based on hours worked. So if you work 30 hours, you get, in California, you get an hour of paid sick time. And, you know, that 30 hours can occur in 1 week, but it can also occur in a month. It doesn't matter.
Now, what about family leave? Could that be used if, say, you aren't sick, but a member of your family is?
Yeah, actually, even paid sick time can be used to care for family members. Paid family leave is a more comprehensive law, but it has a waiting period in California and all the other states that have it now. It's meant for a more long-term kind of situation. So if, for example, you're married and your partner or spouse has a heart attack and you need to take time off from your job to help them get through that recovery process, which might go on for some months, that's what paid family leave can be used for. But you have to, I believe it's either a 1 week or a 2 week waiting period. So it wouldn't work for a short term, you know, a flu or something like that.
We're talking to Ruth Milkman, professor of labor and sociology at City University of New York, former director of the UCLA Institute for Research on Labor and Employment. You know, thinking, I don't know how many employees, part-time or full-time, read the employee handbook all the way through from cover to cover, Ruth. So I'm wondering how aware do you think the average worker is of their rights when it comes to sick leave?
You know, that is a huge issue. Myself and an economist called Eileen Applebaum, who now is in D.C., we did a ton of research on that question in relation to paid family leave. We surveyed both California workers at a series of different points before the law was passed, after it was passed, and then like 5 years after it was passed. And we found that less than half of adult Californians knew that paid family leave existed, even though it covered them. And so that is an enormous issue. We haven't done a survey like that with paid sick time, but I'd be willing to bet my bottom dollar that it's similar. You hear about these things when you need them. In the case of paid family leave, it's mostly used for parental leave. And so if you become pregnant or adopt a baby or something, somebody might tell you about it. But this is just not on the radar of a lot of folks.
So for the workers, Ruth, who know about their sick leave, very aware of it, do they take advantage of them generally? Do Americans just take advantage of their sick leave if they got it?
So it really varies. But in a lot of workplaces, the workplace culture fostered indirectly by employers and managers is that if you're a committed worker, you're there. We need you. We need you to be devoted 24/7 to your job and whatever hours you're actually paid for, you're supposed to be on site. And so many workers come to work sick all the time, even if it's not a question of risking losing their job. They may be worried about, will they get a promotion or will their manager look at them favorably? Will they get a good shift? That kind of thing. That's another issue. It's a huge question. People have access to these leaves, and they just don't take advantage of them at all.
You know, Ruth, I had a friend who didn't call his sick days. He called them wellness days. And even if he wasn't completely sick, he would use them regularly. He would say, if you want me to be well at work, generally, I need to use these sick days. How selfish should we be about our sick days? And how much planning should we do with them?
You know, it isn't a matter of selfishness because, as we discussed earlier, it's not just you that's affected if you're sick in the workplace. You can infect other people. So it's actually altruistic act to take a wellness day. If you have any kind of communicable illness or might have one, this is the prudent thing to do, not only for yourself, but for your coworkers and customers. So I wouldn't call it selfish.
What's the advice then, Ruth, to people who are working in an office and their coworker comes in sick and that person is sneezing and coughing and just sniffling all over the place? Is there a polite, effective way to tell them to get out of here, to scram, to use your sick day?
So I don't know what's effective or what's polite, but it's a good thing to do to tell the person, hey, you really look sick. You should go home and go to bed. And by the way, this is not just for your sake, but for mine. I don't want to catch that cold or flu or whatever it is you've got. That may not be polite. It's a little pushy, but it's the right thing to do.
You mentioned earlier, sometimes company culture discourages people from using their sick days. What obligation do employers have to make sure, to make absolutely sure that their employees do stay home if they're sick?
I mean, they don't have any legal obligation to do that. The sick days are available to workers if they choose to use them. The employer is under no legal obligation to encourage that. But it seems to me they have some moral obligation to do that. A, to make sure that people know that they are entitled to these days off, and also that they are aware that their actions affect not only that worker, but their coworkers. So unlike a coworker, like what you asked about in your sort of hypothetical office scenario, a supervisor or an employer or a manager, you know, is in a position to say that in a way that reassures the worker that there is no consequence for doing it. So those are the people who really should be trained to do this. A coworker, you know, not so much, because if the person is worried that, you know, it's going to look like they're not committed enough to the job or whatever, a coworker telling them that isn't going to have much impact. But if a supervisor does it, it might.
Ruth Milkman, professor of labor and sociology at City University of New York and former director of the UCLA Institute for Research on Labor and Employment. Ruth, thanks a lot.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Now, as we said earlier, there is no reason for alarm at this point when it comes to coronavirus or COVID-19. The risk to the general public is still low, but health officials and healthcare workers are continuing to prepare for the possibility of more cases in California. KPCC's Robert Garova looked at how some hospitals are doing exactly that. Hey, Robert.
Hi.
All right, so now that we have this new case that came down with COVID-19 from an unknown source, how are hospitals preparing?
Yeah, so I spoke with representatives from a couple big hospitals in LA this morning. Both of them said, you know, one of the main things they're doing is making sure they have areas designated where potential COVID-19 patients can be checked out. So here's what Dr. Neha Nanda said. She's a medical epidemiologist at USC Health System. It runs Keck Medical Center, USC's Verdugo Hills Hospital, and its Norris Cancer Center.
We have created pathways and designated rooms where these patients are going to be evaluated so that both the patient and the healthcare worker are safe and they feel safe while doing that.
So Nanda said at hospitals, that means making sure there are negative pressure rooms at the ready. Those are the rooms that prevent contamination from room to room. And if those type of things aren't available, because they definitely are not in smaller clinical settings, they're looking at setting aside rooms where people can be evaluated. And then, you know, after they leave, the room is left isolated for a time afterwards.
Now, the head of the state's Health and Human Services Department today urged people who think they might have symptoms to use telehealth options before coming into the hospital. What does that mean? And what are hospitals saying?
Well, Dr. Nanda at USC and another doctor I spoke with said they're definitely recommending that as well. So that would mean potential patients calling your doctor first before coming in so that healthcare workers can ask screening questions, you know, I imagine travel questions, things like that. That in turn helps the hospital triage the patient in the right way. You know, Nanda even went a step further and said, when possible, definitely when possible, she's advising her doctors to speak to patients over the phone, even if they're already at the hospital or clinic. That way a doctor can have time, you know, to ask the right questions and prepare themselves with, you know, masks, personal protective equipment, that sort of thing.
All right. So what about those smaller clinics, healthcare facilities you mentioned that maybe don't have negative pressure rooms and facilities that aren't easy to isolate?
I spoke with Dr. Nancy Jin. She's medical director of quality and clinical research with Kaiser Permanente Southern California. Here's what she had to say.
Then you can put up tents, much like you see tents for events for a wedding reception. You can use those same kinds of tents to help to cordon off individuals.
I also asked her, Dr. Jin, about masks and personal protective equipment. She said Kaiser does have a good supply of masks, but she said it's not infinite. One of the ironies, she said, is that China is you know, a large manufacturer of masks.
So we are seeking out the healthcare community in general, other aspects of the supply chain that can provide that kind of equipment and masking for the teams.
And, you know, like everyone keeps saying, and we should keep saying, you know, with all of this, you got to point out that the state's health officials and both doctors I spoke with this morning are continuing to stress that the risk of coming down with COVID-19 remains very low. Hospitals in this case are over-preparing, and many of these procedures are the same they put in place for other health scares that we've had over years, things like SARS or Ebola.
All right, that's KPCC's Robert Garova. Robert, thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Right, in case you did not know, Proposition 13 will be one of the things that you'll have to decide on in Tuesday's election, Tuesday's ballot, actually, Super Tuesday. And it's not the property tax one from way, way back in 1978. No, this one's a little different. This one is aimed at public school construction and renovation. That goes from kindergarten all the way through public universities in California. But the thing is, there's something in the fine print that could be very easy to overlook, easy to miss. We will make you aware of all of it when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds, so stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. With voting well underway in California, we're going to turn our attention to the one state measure on the ballot, and that's Proposition 13. Now, to be clear, it is not the Proposition 13 most of us are familiar with, a property tax measure that was passed way back in 1978. Now, this Prop 13 is a $15 billion bond that would make money available to public schools for construction and other needed renovations. But the measure includes an unusual rider who you might miss if you don't read the fine print, reducing and waiving fees for developers building multifamily housing near public transit. And here to break it all down for us is Matt Levin, reporter for Cal Matters, who wrote all about this for LAist. Matt, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me.
All right, let's start with the basics. Please elaborate on what Prop 13 promises to accomplish if approved by voters.
Sure. So as you mentioned, it's a $15 billion school bond, and the goal is to both build new schools, but more so to renovate and modernize a lot of the dilapidated public schools that you find kind of all around the state. So the money would be intended for getting rid of the asbestos in the multipurpose room or putting in a new air conditioning system in places that haven't had a new one for decades. That's the kind of stated intent, at least from the K-12 side.
Yeah, some schools have not had much since the 80s and 90s, right?
Yeah, that's correct. Some of this bond money would also be used towards those schools that have found lead in their drinking water and cleaning up that problem as well.
Now, in your piece, Matt, you focus on something called developer impact fees. Can you explain what that is for those of us who aren't in the housing development biz?
Yes. So when a developer builds a new housing development, so picture, a bunch of new single family homes out there in the suburbs or even some apartment buildings, maybe in the urban core, okay. A school district will say, hey, if you're going to be building all this new housing, there's probably going to be some families with children that are going to move into it. You got to pay us some money. You got to give us maybe $1,000 a unit or tens of thousands of dollars a unit so we can offset some of the costs of bringing in those new students. Those funds could go to the construction of new schools or they could go to things like the modernization of their current facilities.
So what would Prop 13 do to those fees?
Yeah, so for specific types of new housing development, so namely apartment buildings around high-quality public transit stops, it would eliminate those fees entirely. So developers wouldn't have to pay any money towards school districts for building those units. It would also reduce the impact fees for any type of apartment building within a school district by about 20%. Single-family home developments, you know, those huge new master communities, master plan communities that you find in the suburbs, probably wouldn't be affected by this. But apartment buildings, yes, they would receive this benefit.
So, Matt, how did an incentive for housing developers make its way into this measure focused on repairs in public schools?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. So I think there's a policy answer to that and a politics answer to that. The policy answer is school districts do traditionally rely on three sources of funding to build new schools. So one is state bonds, like the one that voters will be voting on next week, Prop 13. Another is local bonds. And then the third are these developer fees. So when a new bond gets on the ballot, and this is part of the political answer, school developers occurs if the state contribution of money coming from the state bond goes higher, oftentimes that means the developer component also has to increase. So developers might not have been a big fan of this statewide proposition unless it included this type of benefit.
So I'm wondering then, okay, so should Prop 13 pass? Would the money that the school districts get from it outweigh what they'd be losing from the reduced developer impact fees?
So most education advocacy organizations I spoke to said yes, and that's why almost all of them have wholeheartedly endorsed this bond. They desperately want that $15 billion in new money to improve their schools. There is a concern for some school districts that the loss of developer fees could negatively impact them. I spoke with the bond's author, Assemblyman Patrick O'Donnell from the Long Beach area, and he said this was something he was going to be keeping an eye on, that if it turns out that some school districts where there is a lot of public transit and a lot of new development, if this is hurting their budgets, they might have to come up with a new source of revenue.
Talking to Matt. We're talking to Matt Levin, reporter for Cal Matters. Now, these structures are referred to as multifamily developments, but is there evidence to support that families with children would move into these kinds of units, these housing units?
Yeah, so, I mean, when you say multifamily development, you should typically think apartment building. And one of the things that developers will say will be, you know, look, this is exactly the type of development we should be building, right? This is dense development near public transit that's going to reduce traffic and increase our housing stock in the middle of a housing supply crisis where we're millions of units short of where we need to be. Developers will also say those types of buildings, you know, the apartment buildings that are right by the metro station or the BART station there in the Bay Area, when you think of who actually lives there, you think typically single adults or roommates or young couples. You don't think nuclear families that are going to have a bunch of kids.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, so that's the thing. Young families in cities aren't really buying a lot of homes right now. They can't really afford them.
That's right, and that's kind of the cruel irony here is that in some places, because the cost of a single-family home is so expensive, you do see more families with children living in multifamily apartments around public transit, because that's kind of what these young families can afford. It's really hard to save up for the deposit you need for the single-family home in the burbs.
Now, are there other benefits of building more housing located near public transit?
Yes. And these are, you know, some of these I mentioned a little earlier, yeah. But, you know, first and foremost, it's reduction in greenhouse gases, right? If you locate people closer to public transit, the hope is, okay, they'll be using the bus, they'll be using the light rail, and they won't get in their car and drive, you know, an hour and a half to their job. And
that might not own a car, right? Might not even have one.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And that means less carbon emissions that go into the atmosphere, and that's a big goal of Governor Gavin Newsom. And then the other goal, again, is this is a way of increasing housing supply. This is a way of building more densely, creating more units. Governor Newsom has said he has a goal of 3.5 million new housing units by 2025. This type of measure to make it cheaper to build around transit, even though it's kind of weirdly tucked into an education bond, could help towards that goal.
You know, when looking at this part of Prop 13, building around transit, I can't help, Matt, but think of SB 50. Part of the language of SB 50 was to allow higher density housing near job and transit centers. SB 50 has fallen short three times. Is this Prop 13 a bit of an end around for SB 50?
Yeah, so I wouldn't characterize it as an end around. It is definitely in line with the spirit and goals of SB 50, which, as you said, is that piece of very controversial legislation from Senator Scott Wiener from San Francisco that would have upzoned vast swaths of the state. That type of radical transformation of what California cities would look like that was proposed by Senate Bill 50, that is not what's going on here in this developer fee provision in Prop 13. mean. So even though the goals are largely the same, the scale of change is very, very different. This is a way to make it cheaper for developers, but wouldn't propose the type of large-scale reimagining of California cities that Senate Bill 50 did.
All right, finally, one last thing, Matt. Now that we've unpacked what Prop 13 would do, let's talk about how people are responding to it. What groups are supporting it? Who is opposed?
So every major educational constituency is supportive. The California Teachers Association, arguably the most powerful special interest group in the state, has embraced this measure. So has the governor. So have charter school advocates because they want that $15 billion in revenue. There isn't really an organized opposition to it, with the notable exception of the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association, which ironically originated from the original Prop 13 in the late 70s. And their argument is, hey, look, we've approved a lot of these statewide school bonds in the past. We don't know if these funds are being spent very efficiently. And there's also a provision that would allow school districts to borrow more money, which would conceivably allow them to levy more taxes for property owners, which is what the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association kind of hates most.
Matt Levin, reporter for Cal Matters. You can read his piece about Prop 13 on LAIST.com. That's LAIST.com. Matt, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much, Jay.
All right, now turning to a specific school in Orange County, lawsuits, complaints, and late-night board meetings, those have been the backdrops in the ongoing drama between the Orange County School of the Arts and Santa Ana Unified. The district says the school isn't serving kids in the neighborhood. KPCC's Carla Javier went to find out why.
Orange County School of the Arts, or OSHA, is in the heart of downtown Santa Ana. Roxana Guajardo lives about a block over, and when she passes by the school, she notices that the kids...
They're all kind of artsy. Like, a lot of the students are, like, you know, white students, and it's just not something that you see in Santa Ana, especially not in this area.
Santa Ana Unified schools are over 90% Latino. OSHA is less than a quarter Latino. 9 of 10 students at OSHA aren't from Santa Ana. They commute from around Orange County in Southern California, and a handful move from out of state.
You have to ask yourself for whom the charter school exists.
That's Alfonso Jimenez of the Santa Ana Unified School District. The school says it's trying to attract local families. It created a Ballet Folklorico program to appeal to the local art scene, and they offer free after-school classes. But just 7% of those who applied last year were from Santa Ana. I asked the director of that Ballet Folklorico program, Marlene Peña-Marin, why more local kids aren't applying. She says parents ask her about it.
But they would say, I don't think the school is for my child. And I would tell them, why? Why do you think? Well, I just don't think that they'll fit in here.
Santa Ana Unified looked into what might be behind that feeling of not fitting in. First, they looked at how the school was admitting students. State law says if more people are interested in a charter school than there's space for, the school should do a lottery. But for years, OSHA auditioned students. Some parents would pay hundreds for private lessons and coaches. California Charter Schools Association's Mirna Castrojón says generally schools should be careful to make sure.
The purpose of the audition is not to exclude students from participating. The law still applies in terms of ensuring that the lottery is the one that prevails.
The school's founder and executive director, Ralph Opasek, admits the school has never used a lottery before.
I'm not sure I agree that an audition is a barrier for students.
Still, this year, the school replaced auditions with what it's calling placement activities. Here's what we know. Applicants are still submitting portfolios and showing off their skills before admission and before any lottery. And the school will be
identifying students that are either emerging, beginning, intermediate, or advanced.
So that part remains subjective. From there, somehow, the school says applicants will be randomly drawn and offered spots as space allows. First siblings and neighborhood kids, then everyone else. It's complicated.
To be honest with you, we haven't quite figured it out yet.
Neither has the district. It wondered if this process could still discourage some kids from applying. But the admissions process hasn't been the only concern from parents and the district. There's also this thing called the parent funding agreement. And this isn't like selling a couple candy bars.
Each year, we request a tax-deductible donation of approximately $4,000 for junior high students and $4,500 for high school students to be able to continue offering a comprehensive arts program.
That's from a video sent to prospective parents. OSHA is a public school. It gets around $20 million from the state. But that's not enough to cover all the arts. Like all public schools, it cannot charge tuition. So instead, the school asked parents for donations at a mandatory meeting. At those meetings, parents would get a packet and a pledge form. It included suggestions of how to come up with the money. Santa Ana resident Gay Olivos' daughters attended the school. She says she and her husband put their tax returns to it, took some extra jobs, asked others to give a little too.
Was it tight? Yes, it was.
OSHA says the donations are voluntary. Some families don't pay. The school has a fund to help cover some arts costs. But Santa Ana Unified staff worried that the practice could discourage families who couldn't afford it from applying in the first place. In December, the district school board considered OSHA's charter renewal. Its decision:
conditional renewal of the charter for Orange County School of the Arts.
Those conditions: that the school works with them to make sure all kids feel like they could go if they wanted to. The School of the Arts objected to the district's methods and findings. It decided not to revise its charter and appealed to the Orange County Board of Education.
Madam President, what do we do now?
For KPCC News, I'm Carla Javier in Orange County.
Carla will continue her series tomorrow. You can read more of her reporting on our website. That's laist.com. That's laist.com. Malcolm X is more associated with New York City, really, than anywhere else. He didn't make his way out to L.A. that often, but once, after an incident between the LAPD and the Nation of Islam, he did. And it was a press conference held in downtown L.A. that is still remembered nearly 60 years later. Hear all about it when Take Two continues. Stay with us. Lots of news to get to all afternoon long here on KPCC. Nick Roman, host of All Things Considered, is here to tell us what he's got cooking.
Well, of course, coronavirus worries sent stocks diving again today. There is some good news, though. The government says it's resolved a problem with its coronavirus test, and that could clear a testing bottleneck that's hampered the work to slow the spread of the virus in the U.S. We'll have the latest on the outbreak and on the work to contain it. State water officials measured the Sierra snowpack today, third measurement this weekend. As you probably guessed, it's well below average. That means a drier summer, perhaps more wildfires. And we've been reporting a lot about how these new vote centers in L.A. County work. KPCC reporter and L.A. County voter Kyle Stokes went out and tried one. He'll tell us how it went. And that's coming up on All Things Considered at 4 o'clock, right after Marketplace at 3 and The Frame at 3:30.
All right, that's Nick Roman, All Things Considered. Nick, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Good times, good times. There's going to be good times, good times.
Got no job, baby. And my pockets don't seem to have a jingle. But as long as you let me hold you tight, everything is gonna be all right. Oh, yes, it is.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. Last Friday, February 21st, marked the 55th anniversary of Malcolm X's assassination. Though more of a figure on the East Coast, X occasionally made his way west. And on May 4th, 1962, he held a press conference in downtown Los Angeles in response to a bloody altercation between LAPD officers and members of the Nation of Islam.
The Negro press came to us and asked us our story. The Negro press came to us and asked us what took place. Listen, ma'am, the Negro press, the Sentinel, the Eagle, the Herald Dispatch, Jet, all the Negro press, and not only them, across the country, New York, Amsterdam News, Philadelphia Tribune, all of the Negro papers asked us what happened.
This press conference, held at the old Statler Hilton Hotel, was one of the few opportunities during Malcolm X's life where the press could ask direct questions of him. And that tape you heard is the only footage that remains. And that is the subject of today's Throwback Thursday.
California, land of romance.
There is probably no single area holding so much of charm and beauty and the good things of life as Southern California.
Once a sleepy ranch town, now home to the stars of Tinseltown, the captains of industry and over 1 million men, women, and children.
There are boys and girls from the large cities and small towns. Each brings his dreams, his hopes, and his ambitions.
Mike Holland is the Los Angeles City Archivist who's in possession of this rare tape, and he's here to tell us all about its significance. Mike, welcome back.
Hey, thanks, A.
All right, let's first talk about the incident that was the catalyst for this press conference. It took place late in the evening of April 27th, 1962. What happened?
Nation of Islam had a series of mosques that they had established across the country in major cities. And so Los Angeles was home to Mosque number 27. And in 1961, there had been an incident between LAPD and some of the mosque members that kind of went haywire. But once things settled down, the mosque kind of became one of those targets that LAPD was keeping an eye on. And so they did their surveillance. They did all the things that they were doing at the time. And so on April 27, it was after midnight, the version of the of events that Nation of Islam told was that there had been some donated clothing items that were going to be distributed. And so two mosque members were taking these things from the mosque to their car and putting in the trunk of the car.
Okay.
LAPD said that these guys were burglars and they were carting off stolen property. So obviously there's a disconnect between those two versions of events. But what did happen after that is there was a large police presence that descended on this particular area. And as a result of the altercation, there were gunshots fired. Six Muslims were injured, and one by the name of Ronald Stokes was shot dead.
What about on the LAPD side of things?
LAPD said that they had one officer who was injured in the melee, and there was some question as to whether it was friendly fire. As a matter of fact, in the press conference, that question was asked of Malcolm, and he said they probably shot each other because, as he put it, Muslims aren't allowed to carry weapons, firearms, not even nail files.
All right, so let's listen to Malcolm X, because roughly a week later, Malcolm X called that press conference at the Statler Hilton Hotel. Let's hear a little bit more of that.
When you give a man as much power as Los Angeles has given him, and you don't have anyone around here who seems nerve enough to challenge him, naturally he does the same thing that Hitler did in Germany. He begins to think that he is God, and any act that he commits is a godly act, no matter how atrocious it is.
That's Malcolm X. They're talking about the chief of police at the time, William Parker. What was it that Malcolm X hoped to get across with this press conference?
What he wanted to get across from the press conference was to lay the blame of the incident at the feet of LAPD and Bill Parker specifically. In that particular clip, he refers Parker in the same sentence as Adolf Hitler as being all-powerful and therefore godlike in anything that he says or does. Beyond that, what he wanted to do was to focus on the fact that this was not just an argument between LAPD and the Nation of Islam.
And this might be the only copy, as far as you know, right?
We believe it is. We're not even sure how it got there. There's two possibilities. LAPD was in the habit of shooting footage of people they deemed as troublemakers. And so they could very well have had someone in the room with the camera, which would have also included microphones and various other things. So it was kind of hard to hide in an open room like that during a press conference. They'd done that kind of thing before. It could be that someone else was there on their behalf, such as one of the local TV stations, and LAPD got a copy of the film that they collected. And through decades, that just happens to be the copy that seems to have survived. There's no hint or indication of who actually shot it.
What makes this film like this so important in today's day and age?
Well, in this day and age, anything new that turns up with Malcolm X or Martin Luther King or any, the Kennedys or any major figure, I mean, that's gold. because all of the stuff that we already know about has been shown, the same footage is usually shown in the same documentaries every single time. But it's nice when something does turn up unexpectedly because someone finally decided, I wonder what's in that particular reel of tape or this particular reel of film, for example, and I discover, oh my God, I didn't know they shot that. And so you just never know what's going to turn up. And, you know, the more people know about these sorts of things, maybe they'll start looking around and seeing, you know, my relative was in LA at that time. They worked for one of the newspapers. Maybe they had a scrapbook or some photographs or some other sort of material about that particular event or that particular episode.
Yeah, you never know right where it might be, how you might find it. That's the
Absolutely.
Whole point, right? Yeah.
And then, of course, as time goes on, these things get scarcer and scarcer and scarcer. And so the time to find any of that stuff and make it available is now.
All right. So what are the things that Malcolm X talked about in that press conference? We played a couple of things. What questions were asked of him? How did he answer them?
He read a statement, a prepared statement first from Elijah Muhammad, who is the spiritual leader of the Nation of Islam, got that out of the way. Mm. Then he took questions. And this was interesting to me because this was probably one of the few occasions that LA journalists had a chance to actually, you know, talk to him and actually ask him questions. So one of the questions that came up was, what's his name all about? You know, Malcolm X, you know, what's the X for? And so then he went into a short explanation. And he was also asked about, well, what are the differences between the Nation of Islam and the NAACP? And he said, we don't believe in integration. They do. We both agree on human rights and fair treatment of all people. That we agree on. Mm-hmm. He was also asked some other things about Bill Parker, about the chief of police. Had he actually heard back from Parker's people? And he hadn't. There were a few other interesting questions. And the whole thing is fascinating. It runs about 20-odd minutes. And it's just wonderful stuff.
And for longtime Angelenos who are trying to connect William Parker, yes, the Parker Center, the old LAPD HQ in downtown, that's who that building was named for. They're no longer there anymore, but that's the Parker Center right there.
Give
us a point in time on this, because I know he was assassinated in 1965. That's about 3 years after the press conference. Mm-hmm. Considering, though, how it was kind of under the radar in a lot of ways, what would you say the lasting impression of Malcolm X and the Nation of Islam in Los Angeles is?
He's become more of a moderate figure compared to, say, what Farrakhan, who took over the Nation of Islam and has been for a number of years, has done. I mean, you don't usually get streets named after you unless you have become a respectable individual. And so Malcolm's got several streets named after him. There's two of them in New York, one in Brooklyn, one in Harlem. Mm. There's a Malcolm X Boulevard in Dallas, Texas, of all places. And there's a Malcolm X Street in Lansing, Michigan. But, of course, L.A.'s not left out of this one either, because there's actually a Malcolm X Way near the intersection of Central Avenue and Martin Luther King Boulevard.
No kidding. Wow.
Even though those two were diametrically opposed in almost every way. But as Malcolm pointed out, I'm sure Martin would have probably said so many times, they did both agree on human rights, human dignity, for all people of all color.
Wow. Mike Holland is Los Angeles City's archivist. He's here today talking about the rare video of a Malcolm X press conference in L.A. Mike, as always, thanks a lot.
Thank you, A.
If you'd like to watch some of the Malcolm X video discovered by the City Archive, head over to our Instagram to watch some clips. You can find us at Take Two Show. All right, if you used to ride a skateboard, get back on one, because a new study has identified all kinds of reasons why getting in a session is actually really good for you. We'll tell you all about it in 60 seconds. Stay with us.
Ooh, yes, it is. It's been a long time.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. Feel a little blah? Well, hop on a skateboard. USC researchers talked to 5,000 young people about their passion for the sport and concluded it's really good for your overall well-being. Neftali Williams co-authored the study.
It's the only way that they get rid of some of the stress that's both brought on by school or socioeconomic conditions or things that are going on in their life. So actually just getting out and actually having the ability to be physical with something that doesn't have rules, that's one of the key things.
The study found that skaters are often critical thinkers and problem solvers, and that the sport often brings people together from diverse backgrounds. The Tony Hawk Foundation funded the USC survey of 13 to 25-year-olds, and Hawk, as you may remember, is a retired professional skateboarder, one of the best of all time. But the findings did match up with a conversation we had back in 2018 with a guy named Keegan Gizzard. Though skateboarding is at the heart of Southern California culture, Gizzard felt that as an activity, it was still associated with slackers. So a couple of years ago, he and a group of SoCal skaters decided it was time to create the first and only National College Scholarship Fund for student skateboarders.
There has historically been a stereotype that skateboarders are kind of burnout types. They just drink and smoke and do whatever they want to. There haven't been good role models for them to move forward in a positive way. And times have changed. There weren't those role models for them. Now there are. Going to school is something that can be good for skaters, and so we're just trying to push that narrative.
How did you get people behind this idea? Because I can imagine someone right off the bat from the surface says, okay, wait a second, a scholarship program for skateboarders? Why?
Right. Why would you do that?
Yeah. Why would you do that, Keegan?
Skateboarding is actually the most popular athletic activity in LA County by frequency, which I think says a lot. It wasn't like that 10 years ago. I've been skating now for 20 years, and I've seen a lot of friends, acquaintances, and people I've met traveling here and there who have talent on a skateboard and have a lot of potential off that skateboard too, and I can see that, and I can see that they're not being encouraged or pushed in a certain direction that would just make a better life for them.
So what was the application process like? What is it like? Because I noticed online that you had to click, yes, you are a skateboarder, which actually was kind of funny to me a little bit because it's like, okay, so fine. What if I'm not a skateboarder? I said, okay, I'll just apply anyway. So how do you decide that a skateboarder is getting the scholarship?
One of the optional fields was to provide your Instagram account because it's so prevalent in skateboarding and it's a way to show what you've been doing on your board to your friends and what have you. Also, the essay questions were, how did skateboarding find you, and or what types of things you might have done for your local skateboarding community?
So you picked seven. Of how many applicants would you say, roughly?
Almost 250 the first year. We're pretty proud of that.
So Keegan, the scholarship itself, when most people think scholarship, they think, okay, it's some money to go to a traditional four-year school. Under the parameters of your organization, what does educational opportunities mean?
What we mean here is any type of institution where you go to pursue an education that can further your life in some way. So whether that be to a four-year university and you're studying English literature, or you're going to a two-year university for an associate's degree, or a trade school for welding, or you're getting your MBA at Harvard.
Keegan, looking at the skateboarder skating behind me, I just realized there's no way in a million years I could ever do any of the things they're doing. You fall down, you get up. It just seems like it would take too long for me to learn anything. But I think that's the beauty of skateboarding, right, is that it takes a long time and it takes a lot of failure. So I'm wondering, with that discipline in mind, what makes a skateboarder potentially an interesting student?
You nailed it right there. It definitely takes a long time to build real skill, a lot of limping home. But because of that, people who stick with skating for over a decade, you can tell there's a certain level of grit that they acquire. Having acquired that characteristic of grit translates directly into getting through whatever project, studying for whatever exam, writing whatever paper or even thesis that you would in school. If you learn how to deal with the bad days and the bad weeks, the bad moments, and still learn that trick in skateboarding and prevail, then that can translate to accomplishing any task, really, or any assignment, and finding pride in the end of it.
Keegan, then considering how you mentioned that the credibility of skateboarding is at an all-time high, it's being included in the Olympics and people are looking at it differently, I'm wondering if maybe down the road you see a future where colleges would offer scholarship for skateboarding, just like maybe they would for a football player.
Yeah, I think athletic scholarships for skateboarding are definitely going to happen at some point. And certain universities, based on proximity to the skateboarding industry or areas of the country with higher participation, are going to be the first ones to do that and adapt to that. On a greater scale, it's going to take a little bit of time to see how the talent funnel to the Olympic Games goes and how we can streamline that using college programs and university programs. The blueprint for that hasn't been laid out yet, but it's definitely begun.
That's Keegan Gazzard. He's Executive Director of the College Skateboarding Educational Foundation. Keegan, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you very much, eh? We appreciate it.
You know, Keegan and I were at a skate park during that interview. I did try to skate, but it was a disaster. The skateboard slipped under me. I fell. The thing almost hit someone else. It was no good. No good for me. All right. You can always find us on social media. We're at Take Two on Twitter, at Take Two. You can find me there as well, at AMartinezLA, AMartinezLA. That's good for Twitter and Instagram. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two. We'll be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.